I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear two speeches from the panel I moderated at the Left Forum on May 31st, 2015, about the deep state. The two speakers are Canadian professor and author Dr. David McGregor and Russ Baker, author of the book Family of Secrets about the Bush family. Peter Dale Scott, who has written extensively on the deep state, defines it
as a power not derived from the Constitution, but outside and above it. It is more powerful than the public state.
So let's begin with Dr. David McGregor. Since this was taped live, there are some background noises that couldn't be edited out.
I'm honored to be on the panel today in place of Peter Dale Scott, who kindly asked me to substitute for him. I accepted Peter's invitation to replace him with considerable trepidation. No one could realistically substitute for him, given Peter's extraordinary knowledge of American deep history. And I certainly cannot pretend to do so. What I'll do is I'll discuss the areas I think that Peter intended to discuss himself today. I've been listening to quite a few of his interviews, his recent interviews, so I think I'm fairly up to date with what he's been thinking. Much of what I will say is closely drawn from Peter's publications, especially his new book, which I brought with me, The American Deep State, just published last fall. The cover of Peter's new book includes a striking image of a plane flying over the White House. He explains the image as follows. Many people are unaware that on the morning of 9/11, during the attack on the Pentagon, the so-called Doomsday Plane, the E-4B, and you can look that up in Wikipedia, which I just did a couple of hours ago, the E-4B appeared briefly in the forbidden airspace over the White House and the Capitol. The E-4B, a product of continuity of government planning, is a survivable mobile command post based at Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska for the National Command Authority. By the way, the National Command Authority is the President and the Secretary of Defense, and they're supposed to be on that plane. The purpose of the plane, to quote CNN, is to keep government running no matter what, even in the event of a nuclear war. And that's the reason it was nicknamed the Doomsday Plane during the Cold War. Its presence on 9/11 has never been officially acknowledged or explained. Unofficially, it has been attributed to a war game scheduled for the same day. Metaphorically, the E-4B flyover of the White House in 9/11 symbolizes the way the COG plans, that is, continuity of government plans, preempted constitutional authority. And of course, President Bush was sent to Offutt Air Force Base, not in that plane, but he was sent there on 9/11. Anyway, that was from Peter's introduction to his book, talking about continuity of government, which Peter points out actually connects a lot of what he calls deep events. And continuity of government really started back in the Kennedy years, Peter has learned, and it continued throughout Watergate and into 9/11, the era of 9/11. I'll just talk about deep events to start off with. A deep event, according to Peter, is such as Kennedy assassination or Watergate. These are deep events. 9/11, they transform America, but they also transform the world. They usually end up with some kind of excuse or reason for war. Deep events repeatedly, and this here's again a direct quote from Peter, Peter says that deep events repeatedly involve law-breaking or violence, are mysterious to begin with, embedded in ongoing deep processes, have consequences that enlarge covert government, and are subsequently covered up by systematic falsification in the media and in internal government records. Structural deep events, as he calls them, structural deep events, such as Kennedy's murder, which opened the way for the escalation of the Vietnam War, or Nixon's removal by deep forces, which breached democratic barriers to a renewed Cold War in the USSR, and 9/11, of course, unleashed a terrible series of wars in which we are still involved almost 15 years later. The political activities of the deep state are the chief source and milieu of what Peter calls deep politics, a term he first used in the mid-1990s in his book, Deep Politics and the Death of JFK. As Peter points out, an earlier version of this concept was put forward by C. Wright Mills. C. Wright Mills, a sociologist, actually taught in Columbia, but he was from Texas. He invented a term called the power elite, in which he talked about invisible government and the collusion of the military and the big business and political operatives in the governing of the United States. Peter has put forward, a few years later, a similar concept. Mills took it for granted that these were public figures, that we could see them on television, we knew who they were, we didn't know what they were saying to each other all the time. However, in Peter's concept, the invisible government or the deep state, we often don't see these people. We don't see them operating except if they are exposed. So it's a different kind of concept. Peter discusses what he calls the secret linkage. So he's talking about a linkage between politics, the intelligence community, big business, and organized crime. Mills talked about the military as being the most dangerous aspect of the power elite, the people that were the most poisonous and evil part of the power elite. Now, Peter actually thinks the military these days is in some ways a constraining force on the deep state. But in some ways, the military command of the United States is a moderate compared to the rest of the deep state. I've heard him say that a couple of times, which I was glad he did because I began to think that myself recently as well, that in fact the military looks like certainly a moderate force compared to the other members of the deep state. In about the mid-1930s, there was a Marine general named Smedley Butler who stopped the overthrow of FDR. And this has actually happened. It was in the papers. There was all kind of congressional inquiries. It was a big deal at the time. Of course, you'll never see it in your history books. It's gone, because it's an example of deep politics. You'll never read about Smedley Butler and the overthrow of FDR in a regular historical book, because that didn't happen, as far as they're concerned. So there is this kind of thing that goes on where things happen, they disappear, they reappear, they disappear again. It seems to be an aspect of the deep state. In a fascinating interview with Alan Dale, by the way, I recommend Alan Dale. Some of you may be interested in the Kennedy assassination, and Alan Dale is on a program called JFK Lancer, and he does a bunch of interviews of experts on the JFK. We had a fascinating interview with Peter Dale Scott. Scott says that he was a Canadian diplomat in the early 1960s in Poland. He really liked Poland for a number of reasons that he pointed out, but one of the reasons that he liked Poland was because it was like Canada. Everybody knows everybody else. And it's not like the United States is so big. You know, you hardly ever meet anybody more than once, I'm sure, in your country. In my country, you meet the same people all over again. So he liked that aspect of Poland, that it had this kind of familiarity to it. And I think it's, and this may explain why I'm here, right? Peter and I know each other, because almost everybody in Canada knows each other. I thought it would be a useful thing to point out that the deep state is like that, too. The people in the deep state know each other. It's almost like a revolving group of characters that come up again and again. For example, the same characters come up in the Kennedy assassination as in Watergate. Some of the people that are in Watergate come up again in 9/11. It's almost like the Rolodex for the deep state, and people just show up again and again. Howard Hunt being one, a guy that showed up in Watergate, but he was really closely involved in the Kennedy assassination. Or two people you probably haven't heard of, Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, started with Watergate and, of course, are huge in 9/11. And I'm sort of edging into some comparisons between the Kennedy assassination and 9/11. And Peter, I think back in 2008, he began a collection of facts that are true of 9/11, but also true of the Kennedy assassination. There are about 7 or 8 very interesting similarities that Peter picked up between 9/11 and the Kennedy assassination. The first one was that the alleged suspects, Lee Harvey Oswald in the case of Kennedy, and a number of the hijackers in 9/11 were already well known to the intelligence services before the event. So Oswald had a very big file. At least 2 and maybe more of the so-called 9/11 hijackers. By the way, Peter did not believe that any hijackers got on the planes. He's given up on that official theory. He hadn't found any evidence to support the idea that there were hijackers on those planes. But I won't go any further into discussions of 9/11 except to talk about these comparisons. So at least 2 of the alleged 9/11 hijackers were identified well in advance, and law enforcement agencies made sure that these people were not impeded in the months prior to 9/11. The same thing with Oswald. They actually took him off the FBI watch list about a month before the murder of Kennedy. So the first thing is that they are already well known to intelligence authorities. The second similarity is that designated suspects helpfully laid down a paper trail, making it easy to identify them. If you remember, one of the very first things they said was Mohammed Alam, the lead hijacker apparently at 9/11, left his passport in a plane, and somehow that survived the actual crash. There was a paper trail that was huge that you could identify these people with. The same was true of Oswald, who kept showing up on TV, being interviewed and doing crazy things. So that was the designated suspects helpfully laid down a trail for themselves. That's number two. Number three is that they immediately know who these people are. Kennedy was shot at 12:30. The U.S. authorities announced at 1:30 that Oswald did it. By 2:30, he was arrested. That's like amazing police work. And, well, it is, except that, as Peter loves to point out, the way they described Oswald in the police release was not Oswald. Apparently, he was 165 pounds and he was 32, where the real guy was 23 and weighed 135. But anyway, whatever. They knew who he was very shortly after he did it. The same was true, if you recall, 9/11. They know who these people are almost immediately, within a few minutes, which is, for those of us who are doing any kind of research, that's amazing and it's humbling, for sure. So the immediate attribution of the crime to the designated suspects. The authorities immediately insist that the designated suspects acted alone. There was nobody else involved. There was just the 19 hijackers who apparently were not communicating with anyone except bin Laden, I guess, somewhere. So it wasn't a conspiracy. They were acting alone. They were up there in the planes. And of course, the same thing was true of Oswald. He was acting alone. Although at the very beginning, Peter talks about the double aspect of the Kennedy assassination. For the first, I'm not sure how long, but maybe for the first day, maybe for the first few hours, they were suggesting it was a Soviet plot, and that Kennedy had been shot by Castro in favor of the Russians. They gave that one up after a few hours, and they put another one in. But Oswald was always the suspect. He just had different reasons. So the authorities insist again in the Kennedy assassination that very quickly became just Oswald acting alone, no conspiracy. And of course the same is true of bin Laden, who was supposed to be so rich and so powerful that he could do anything he wanted to do, you know, including attack New York, and something the Russians were never able to do. And you know, they were, why didn't we think of that? Three planes, we could have just blown up the United States and it would have been so easy. But you know, bin Laden had certainly an extremely, extremely amazing abilities. So that's number four, they acted alone. And finally, both events involved, and this is where Peter's research is really interesting, both events involved drug smuggling. So we find drugs all over the Kennedy assassination. Drugs are part of Watergate. Drugs are also part of 9/11. There's an interesting, it's almost like an undercurrent throughout these so-called deep events, the notion of drugs and these kind of operations. The Kennedy assassination involved Cuban drug smugglers. In terms of the conspirators, in terms of the Kennedy assassination, you begin to find connections with drugs. One of the first things that happened when the United States went into Afghanistan is that the production of heroin increased, and they began to use drugs, of course, to further destabilize Russia by putting all kinds of cheap drugs from Afghanistan into Russia. So you have really this aspect of drugs is always a part of deep politics. Global drug operations supply off-the-books funding for activities of intelligence agencies such as the CIA. I was talking to someone last night at a party, and it was a really interesting conversation. We were discussing why was Kennedy shot? Who were the prime suspects? I used to, and I'm sure Peter did too, is we were both skeptical that the mafia was an important part of the assassination. Certainly they were an aspect of it, but not an important part of it. But I think lately Peter's beginning to see the mafia as more important in the Kennedy assassination than he thought they were before. Not that they were the ones that controlled it, but simply because the mafia is almost a total tool of the CIA. So that when Robert Kennedy was investigating the mafia activities, he was getting very close to uncovering some of the things the CIA is involved in, i.e. their very close partnership, if not symbiotic relationship with the mafia, which goes way back to 1948 in Italy. In any event, so we had the connection of deep events and drug smuggling. And let me just talk about how illegal drugs are involved. First of all, illegal drugs provide motivation and support for the criminal empires that are useful tools of these secret government agencies. Trade in drugs is a source of riches for the world financial institutions. You may have read those reports a couple of years ago that suggested that some of the major assets of the banks after 2008 were actually drug assets. That was how they stayed afloat. So we have something that Peter called the financialized plutonomy, the ruling class basically of a financier ruling class, which depends on drugs or uses drugs in its finances and its networks of domination. Finally, the drug trade is a key facilitator of disrupting economic development in the third world. I'm not sure how far Peter would go to say that, but drugs are used to fund terrorists, to fund overthrows of leaders. They turn out to be a really good way to, for example, get rid of Gaddafi or to get rid of Saddam Hussein. We usually find that those kind of overthrow efforts are financed by drugs and helped by drug networks.
And now you'll hear from author and journalist Russ Baker.
So last night we had a little party for some people who were coming in from out of town, and I invited a cross-section of people, some of whom were attending this conference and some of whom didn't know about it and would have been mortified by it. They all had a good time, I think, interesting conversations. One of the things that struck me afterwards was I went out for a drink with a fellow who writes for some of the major magazines you would have heard of, has some best-selling books, and he looked literally terrified. And, I mean, literally looked terrified. And I said, what is wrong? And he said, I can't be seen with these people. And he said, it's so hard to establish any kind of credibility. This fellow always has problems with his editors, with his books, he lawsuits, all sorts of things. He really does very bold work, but he's really, by I think the lights of many people here, a very mainstream, cautious fellow, and yet he has difficulties throughout his career, and I have had difficulties throughout my career. It's kind of funny that when I meet people, they either tell me that I'm a tool of the establishment or I'm a radical nut. So I figure they always say, if everybody's mad at you, you must be doing something right. But basically, being in the media is tough, and trying to figure out what the heck is going on is tough, and telling the truth as you see it is tough. It's really not very welcome. And in fact, since the title was supposed to be The American Deep State, How Capitalism Subverted Democracy, just to talk about the role of capitalism in journalism, there is no real incentive for us to get good information about the actual state of things. There is no real reason for journalism to tell us what is actually going on and who's doing it. That's not the model. If journalism, like pretty much everything else in capitalism, is about making money, then you do whatever you can to make money. And that means giving people things that amuse them, distract them, don't upset them, cater to or pander to whatever it is that they think or they want to hear. Certainly a big part of it is not losing advertisers. Years ago, I was an editor at the Columbia Journalism Review. We did a piece on things going on at magazines where they were being told by their own chiefs, their own editors, not to do certain subjects. And remember, one of them, an advertiser had objected because they did a thing about sudden infant death syndrome, even though this magazine was all about how your child could thrive, and you would think that would, you know, having your baby not die would be relevant. But in any case, they didn't want that in there, and the memo went out that the advertisers preferred what was called happy baby editorial. And so, you know, a lot of this stuff is actually not even a conspiracy. It's just a system that is sort of cynical, money-oriented, kind of fundamentally corrupt, a bit lazy. That's not to say there is not a deep state, but there's also just this kind of deep inertia, too. Years ago, there were a couple of times I was brought over to the New York Times to talk to them. They really loved what I did, and they said we could really use some good gumshoeing here and, you know, want to get you in. And so I'd come in to talk to them, and every time something went wrong, and this particular time I had written, they had called me to write an op-ed for them, which I did, and then somebody from the op-ed pages had me out to lunch, and he said, bring your clips with you, and I did. And at the time, I was writing for the Village Voice, if any of you remember, about 20 years ago, doing big cover stories for them on the CIA and what have you. And he was flipping through my articles, and one of them was called CIA Out of Control. And it was from, I think, 1991 or 92, and it said, now that the Soviet Union is gone, do we have any more enemies? And if not, then what the heck is the CIA up to? And so at the end of this article, which was full of facts, I had some statement in there saying, and this is why many former CIA people that I know tell me that they consider the CIA to be little more than the foot soldiers of the rich. And he read that, and he went, I looked at him, and he said, why do you write things like that? I said, well, I don't know. I suppose it's true. He said, that doesn't matter. Don't you understand? And he said, oh, God. And he could just see there the prospects of him bringing me in had just vanished. And so it's not even that the New York Times is, and by the way, I want to talk for a few minutes, it's about Operation Mockingbird. How many of you have heard of that? Oh, okay, pretty well for the crowd. This was a CIA effort under Alan Dulles to basically put CIA operatives or friends into key positions in the media. That, we know, it was documented during the Church Committee hearings in the 70s. It happened in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. Frankly, I suspect it's still going on, because why wouldn't it be? I think all governments, all leaders, if you go back to medieval England, one thing the king and the nobles all understood was, if you didn't want the peasants and the townsfolk and so on coming at you with pitchforks and bonfires, you needed to sedate them, you needed to threaten them, you needed to do all the co-opt them, do all these different things. And you also, it was very, very important to know what they were talking about, and then to make sure that what they were hearing was something that was favorable to you. And so this is nothing new. I mean, it's always done. And this was this program that Frank Wisner, with his, what they called the Mighty Wurlitzer, the beautiful music they would play through all their good friends at Newsweek and Harper's and, you know, all of these magazines. And the funny thing is, or maybe not funny, is that the real targeting that goes on, to my mind, is not in the Fox News, it's in the liberal magazines. And I know this for a fact because I've written for many of those magazines, and whenever I did really, really big stories, I mean, that were really big, they didn't want them. They only wanted things that were kind of advancing that partisan left, right, Democratic, Republican, you know, social issues, whatever. When you went too deep, they suddenly said, you know, I don't think people are interested in this. Yeah. Part of that is, again, not that they're officially working for any of these outfits, but that they've now been invited, they got a regular gig on MSNBC or whatever, and they're finally, you know, being welcomed in, and you don't want to kind of taint that by entertaining unthinkable thoughts. And so the machine grinds on, and people are kept in what I consider to be a sort of a fantasy state. And I have to say, and this with all due respect to everybody here, I think that this conference also is in a fantasy state, but it's in a different fantasy state because it's very fragmented to everybody's interest group and, you know, whatever it might be. And listen, I support the rights of every group everywhere in the world, but the truth of the matter is we have really serious problems, like looming fascism in this country, possibly the end of life on Earth due to climate change. And the fact that we're so fragmented, I think, serves only those same interests that have always dominated. And so it is a kind of a fantasy state where we all have our own little silo that we get into. And I myself have experienced a number of things, and maybe if I have time to talk for a few minutes about some sort of deep state stories that we've done. I got so frustrated with the narratives being inadequate. I couldn't imagine, you know, I'd say, well, why is George W. Bush even president of the United States? I mean, it just seems crazy. And I would ask people, and nobody had a good answer. They all had semi-smart retorts, but nobody had a good answer. And so I actually started digging in. I spent 5 years, and the result was, I don't know, any of you read this book? And what I did was I discovered there was a whole other narrative behind the rise of this family, and it had to do with the deep state. And that's how I got to be friends with Peter Dale Scott, because I discovered this whole analysis I wasn't even aware of, that all these people actually do know each other. They all go to school together, the same prep schools. They vacation together. They live in the same enclaves. And some of the families literally go back, I kid you not, like, you know, 300 years ago. I found some Bush family person in Rochester, New York, doing land speculation with people connected with George Washington. I mean, it's quite amazing. And of course, when you know people, you know them, and then you know them, and you know them, and you know them as the years go by, and you always talk to each other about how things are going. And so, I don't view it as a kind of a cabal, like in Eyes Wide Shut with people wearing hoods and doing incantations, although they may well do that also. But it is a way of life and a value system. And so, and then I started an organization called Who, What, Why. WhoWhatWhy.org. We're a nonprofit organization, and we do news online. We're small. We don't take any ads. All of our money has to come from, as they say, readers like you. But what we're trying to do is to dig into things that just seem really strange. So, for example, one thing that seems strange to us, when I wrote about the Bush family, I discovered stuff about the Kennedy assassination. I always thought Lee Harvey Oswald did it. I don't know where I was, but I thought, you know, I didn't know anything about, you know, Martin Luther King. I thought it was James Earl Ray. But when you start looking at these things, you do see it literally, the FBI is involved, the same people, et cetera, et cetera. They're all weirdly similar. Like my friends in Hollywood who write screenplays, they'd all get thrown out for writing scripts like that because it's too predictable. And so we started looking at all these things, and one of them that we looked at was this Boston Marathon bombing. How many of you have a question or a doubt about the official narrative? Okay, some of you. Okay. The thing was, they again, you know, the FBI is invincible, as David was saying. I mean, they got their man almost immediately. It was like, you know, put up a video. Does anybody know who this is? We've caught him. Okay, now you can leave your homes. And I just thought, wow, that is just amazing. That because, you know, there's always this testimony how the FBI screwed everything else up. Remember this? The crime lab got everything wrong. Their experts lied or were incompetent. The agents were browbeating people. The reports are full of misspelled names of suspects. And yet, and when it's really difficult, they always get their man. And I remember that I got an email from a guy named Emmett Salem, who's, you may remember him from the World Trade Center bombing, the first one. He was the FBI guy who was inside the plot. And then he actually taped himself talking to the FBI handler. And he said, well, actually, you know, we did the bomb. He said, you guys told me to, and they go, well, never mind, never mind. You know. So he read our articles about Boston, and he wrote me a note. He said, appreciate what you're doing, which is interesting. But my little joke is that the reason the FBI always gets their man is because it's their man. They know him. So anyway, the Boston thing was weird. And as soon as we heard that the FBI was forced by the Russian FSB Internal Security Agency to admit that they already knew Tamerlan Tsarnaev, they were like, oh, yeah, well, we knew him, but we didn't know he was, and we didn't really know him. And we asked him if he was a terrorist, and he said he wasn't. And that was the end of that, you know. And so, you know, they're vaunted, but yet they get away with murder on all this stuff. So we looked at that. We've written about 72 articles on the Boston Marathon bombing, I think almost all of which have some new information, some new analysis. We have a growing audience that reads it. I was profiled in Boston Magazine. WGBH Boston interviewed me a few times. So the mainstream media respects us and what we do, and yet they kind of say, isn't that a little like grassy knoll? Are you maybe a little, you know? And then privately they're like, listen, I got to get it on the air somehow. And so this is what we're dealing with. And these stories don't get picked up by the media at all. And in fact, if you read all your favorite publications out there, none of those lefty publications, I don't think one of them mentions any of this stuff that I'm telling you. And that's why I don't trust them either, because they're not doing real. Real journalism is where you don't have a dog in the fight. Real journalism where you just scratch your head and you go, I wonder what that's about. I wonder what really happened. It's not that it serves your ideology, because that's bull. That has nothing to do with journalism. Journalism is like, is it raining outside or isn't it? And so that's what we did with the Boston thing. Another story we did on 9/11 was, I don't know if you know this story about Sarasota, Florida. This got some publicity when NPR, Ira Glass, or somebody did a little sliver of it, I guess. But basically what happened was the alleged hijackers, several of them visited a house in a gated community in Sarasota, Florida. And so we have the gate records and everything, and the FBI investigated it. And they wrote up a report saying the hijackers were somehow connected to the people living in this house. Now, if that's the biggest story in the world, which it was and in many ways still is, you would think that if the people who did it were connected to people living in a house in the United States, that somebody might be interested in this. That this, maybe this was the command post, right? And that you mention this to people and they say, oh, I don't know, I gotta go. I got to pick up the kids, you know. So you say, like, listen, we have a whole new homeland security complex in this country. We're all living in fear because of this thing, but we don't look at the thing. And so we did this story, and it turned out that the people living in the house were directly connected to one of the most powerful princes in the Saudi royal family, who was in charge of aviation in his country, and he himself trained to fly planes in South Florida. So these are the kind of things. I think it's sort of interesting, don't you think? I mean, it's not an exact snoozer, you know? Because I get calls all the time from, like, reality shows and stuff. They're like, your stuff is amazing. We want to put you on a conspiracy show, you know? So, you know, but, I mean, it's really interesting stuff. It's about things that have changed our world and our lives. And yet, somehow, the media can't cover it. And the reason they can't cover it, and this is really, I think, the crux of where I'm trying to go with this somewhat wandering thing, is that it's professional suicide to take on topics that are verboten. That's not just here. That's everywhere in the world. And I remember when I was taking family secrets around Europe and meeting with people in places like Sweden and so on to talk about getting, you know, foreign editions done, they were scared themselves in their own countries. Denmark, Sweden, the Netherlands, you know, all these places, they were worried. You know, they said, this stuff is amazing. It's so new. It cuts against what all of our, see, their media all read the New York Times and their national radio and so on. And so they think that the New York Times is the gold standard, or the Guardian, which also doesn't cover any of this either. And they think that they're getting the truth, or they whatever they read. And so when you come to them with a whole new set of facts, it's total what? Cognitive dissonance. People can't handle it, because it's just like if you know somebody who's in an abusive relationship and you can see it's abusive and they can't, and you say to them you're in an abusive relationship, how do they react? With hostility, right? because if they were in an abusive relationship, they would have gotten out, wouldn't they? And so we're all sort of in an abusive relationship, you might say. Our media is sort of in an abusive relationship. So because I think we started late, I'm going to stop a little early and hopefully we'll have time for questions. Thank you.
And again, you just heard two speeches given at the Left Forum on May 31st, 2015. The first speaker was author and professor David McGregor, and the second was author and journalist Russ Baker. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.